disappeared and returned with an older wife, also in labor, who proceeded to deliver in the horse-drawn gharry beside the outpatient steps. Hemulata ran out in time to cut the cord. She pushed on the wife's belly, but instead of the afterbirth, a twin popped out. Adid smiled when he saw the second child, the third total, reached from ear to ear. Hema suggested he wear a banner across his chest that said, "One night, two shots, three kids." Adid had laughed like a man who'd never heard the word worry.
"Yes, yes,"
he said now, raising his voice to be heard over the drone of the engines. He had the clipped, French-accented diction of a Djiboutian. "A man is only as rich as the number of children he fathers. After all, what else do we leave behind in this world, Doctor?" Hema, who'd been thinking along similar lines just minutes before, decided she was a pauper by that yardstick. She said,
"Amen. You must be a millionaire many times over, then."
An impish expression stole across his face, and with waggling brows and using just his eyes, he pointed down the bench to a woman veiled and swathed in red and orange cotton robes. A very pale, henna-painted foot showed. Hemulata guessed her to be a Yemeni, or else a Muslim from Pakistan or India.
"And she is?"
Hema said, hoping it would not be impolite to ask about her nationality. Adid nodded vigorously.
"3 months more at least, and one more expecting at home."
"I tell you what,"
Hema said, looking pointedly at Adid's groin.
"I'll ask Dr. Ghosh to give you a special rate on a vasectomy, 2-for-1. It will be cheaper than doing a tubal ligation on all the begums."
The Gujarati couple across from her looked up, scowling at Adid's thigh-slapping laughter.
"Why don't you bring the wives to the antenatal clinic?"
Hema asked.
"A smart man like you shouldn't wait till they get into trouble. You don't want them to suffer."
"It's not my choice. You know how these women are. They won't come until they are unconscious,"
he said simply. True enough, Hemulata thought. Years before, an Arab woman in the Mercato was in labor for days, and the husband, a rich merchant, brought Dr. Bocelli to see her. But rather than allow a male doctor to see her, she wedged her body behind the bedroom door so that any attempt to open it would crush her. The woman died alone, behind that door, an act much admired by her peers. Because Hema was hungry, and to annoy the Gujaratis further, she accepted some leaves of khat from Adid and tucked them into her cheek. It was something she'd never have dreamed of doing before, but events of the last few hours had changed things. The khat was bitter at first, but then the pulpy mass became almost sweet and not unpleasant.
"Wonder of wonders,"
she said aloud, as her face took on the chipmunk bulge and her jaw fell into the lazy, slewing rhythm of the thousands of cart chewers she had seen in her lifetime. Like a pro, she used her handbag as an elbow bolster, and she brought her feet up to the bench, one knee flat, the other under her chin. She leaned toward Adid, who was surprisingly chatty.
"And we spend most of the rainy season away from Addis, in Awede, which is near Harar."
"I know all about Awede,"
Hema said, which wasn't true. She'd driven there years before on a holiday to see the old walled city of Harar. What she remembered about Awede was that the entire town seemed nothing more than a cart market. The houses were hopelessly plain, not a trace of whitewash.
"I know all about Awede," she said again,
and the cart made her feel that she actually did.
"The people there are rich enough to each drive a Mercedes, but they won't spend a cent to paint their front door. Am I right?"
"Doctor, how could you know these things?"
Adid said, astonished. Hema smiled, as if to say, "Very little escapes me, my dear man." And then she was thinking of the Frenchman's balls, of rugiform folds, of the medium raphe that separated one bollock from the other, of the dartis muscles, the cells of Sertoli. Her mind was racing, hyper-aware. The cabin was no longer hot, and it felt good to be heading home. She wanted to say to Adid, "When I was a medical student, we had to do this test on patients to check for visceral pain."
Visceral pain is different from when you bump your knee, for example. Visceral pain comes from the inside, from the body's organs. It's a pain that is tough to characterize, poorly localized, but painful all the same. Anyway, as students, we had to squeeze the testes to check for intact visceral pain because diseases like syphilis can cause the loss of visceral pain sensations. One day, at the bedside of a patient with syphilis, the professor picked on me to demonstrate visceral pain. The men in our group were snickering. I was bold then. I didn't hesitate. I exposed the balls, the testes, excuse me. The patient had advanced syphilis. When I squeezed, the man just smiled at me. Nothing. No pain. No reaction. So I squeezed harder. Really hard. Still nothing. But one of my male classmates fainted. Adid grinned as if she had told him this story. The plane descended, slipping into and out of the scattered clouds over Addis Ababa. The dense forests of eucalyptus trees at first concealed the city. Emperor Menelik had imported eucalyptus years before from Madagascar, not for its oil, but as firewood, the lack of which had almost made him abandon his capital city. Eucalyptus had thrived in the Ethiopian soil, and it grew rapidly, 12 meters in 5 years, and 20 meters in 12 years. Menelik had planted it by the hectare. It was indestructible, always returning in strength wherever it was cut down, and proving ideal for framing houses. The trees revealed clearings with circular thatch-roofed tukuls and a thorn enclosure to keep the animals penned in. Then, at the edge of the city, she saw corrugated tin-roofed houses, abundant and closer together. A church with a short spire came into view, and then the city proper. There was Churchill Road, starting at the railway station and making a steep rise to the piazza, with a handful of cars and buses plying its slope. This glimpse of the city centre, which looked so modern, made her think of Emperor Haile Selassie. He brought about more change in his reign than the country had undergone in 3 centuries. Down at street level, his portrait, the hook nose, the thin lips, the high brow, would be in every house. Hema's father was the emperor's biggest fan because just before World War II, as Mussolini stood ready to invade, Emperor Haile Selassie warned the world of the price of standing by and allowing Italy to invade a sovereign country like Ethiopia. Such inaction, he said, would fuel the territorial ambitions of not just Italy, but Germany. "God and history will remember your judgment," he said famously before the League of Nations. And they did. It made him the symbol of the little guy who'd stood up to the bully and lost. "You see missing hospital, madam?" This from Adid, who peered over her shoulder. "Missing is missing," she said. Near the airport, an entire hillside had turned to a flaming orange from the blooming of the mescal flower, which told her that the rainy season must have ended. Another hillside was covered with lean-tos and shacks of corrugated tin, the colors rust brown or a darker corrosive hue. Each shack shared a wall with its neighbor, so that collectively they looked like long, irregular railway carriages that snaked across the hill, sending buds and offshoots in all directions. The Frenchman buzzed low over the strip so that the customs agent could get on his bicycle and shoo stray cows from the runway. He circled and landed. Cars and vans in the bile green colors of the Ethiopian police raced up to the plane, along with every functionary of the Ethiopian airline staff. The cargo door was yanked open, and frantic hands rushed to unload the cart. They tossed the bundles into a VW combi, then into a three-wheeler van, and when those were full, they stuffed the police cars, and they all raced off, sirens sounding. Only then were the passengers allowed to disembark. The engine of the blue-and-white Fiat 600 whined as the 600-milliliter engine, which gave it its name, strained to carry Hemalatha and her Grundig. She'd personally supervised the loading of the big crate onto the roof rack. It was a perfect sunny afternoon in Addis,
and it made her forget that she was more than 2 days overdue at missing. The light at this altitude was so different from Madras, suffusing what it graced rather than glaring off every surface. There was no hint in the breeze of rain, though that could change in an instant. She caught the woody, medicinal odor of eucalyptus, a scent that would never do in a perfume but was invigorating when it was in the air. She smelled frankincense, which every household threw onto the charcoal stove. She was glad to be alive and glad to be back in Addis. But she didn't know what to make of the wave of nostalgia that overcame her, an unfulfilled longing that she could not define. With the end of the rains, makeshift stalls had popped up selling red and green chilies, lemons and roasted maize. A man with a bleating sheep draped around his neck like a cape struggled to see the road in front of him. A woman sold bundles of eucalyptus leaves used as cooking fuel for making injera, the pancake-like food made from a grain, teff. Farther on, Hema saw a little girl pour batter on a huge flat griddle which sat on 3 bricks with a fire underneath. When the injera was ready, it would be peeled off like a tablecloth, then folded once, twice, and once more, and stored in a basket. An old woman in the black clothes of mourning stopped to assist a mother sling her baby onto her back in a pouch made out of a shama, the white cotton cloth that men and women alike wrapped around their shoulders. A man with withered legs that were folded into his chest swung stiff-armed along the dirt sidewalk. He had blocks of wood with a handle in each hand, which he planted on the ground, and then he swung his bottom forward. He moved surprisingly well, like the letter M marching down the road. Her brief absence made these sights a novelty again. A herd of mules overladen with firewood trotted along, their expressions docile and angelic in the face of the whipping they were getting from the barefoot owner who ran with them. The taxi driver leaned on his horn. Despite the high whine of the engine, the taxi managed only to crawl along like another overburdened beast. A lorry carrying sheep, the poor animals so crowded together they could hardly blink, overtook them. These were the lucky animals being carried to slaughter. Before Meskel, the feast celebrating the finding of Christ's cross, huge herds of sheep would arrive in the capital, the animals wobbly from exhaustion, barely surviving this march to the feast table. Then, in the days after Meskel, one neither heard nor saw any sheep. Instead, the skin traders walked the streets and alleys shouting,
"Yegbo koda ale! The sheep's hide whoever has!"
A household would hail him, and after some haggling, he'd drape another skin over the ones that he was already shouldering and resume his cry. Suddenly, Hemalata noticed children everywhere, as if they'd been invisible all these years. 2 boys were racing their crude metal hoops, using a stick to guide and push, weaving this way and that and making motor car noises. A toddler, with railroad tracks of snot connecting nose to lip, watched with envy. Its head had been shaved to leave a traffic island tufted in front. Hema was told when she first came to Ethiopia that this strange haircut was so that if God chose to take that child, and he took so many, the tuft gave him a handle by which to lift it to heaven. The child's mother stood outlined by the bead curtain of a bunabet, coffee house, though it was really a bar, offering things more potent than coffee. At night, the bar would glow within from the tube lights, painted green, yellow, and red, and the woman, transformed by that hour, would offer drinks and her company. An espresso machine on a zinc bar established the class of an establishment. This was a legacy of the Italian occupation. The woman's flat eyes fell on the cab, then on Hema, and her expression hardened, as if she had seen a competitor. She lifted her gaze to the strange container on the taxi's roof, and then she looked nonchalantly away, as if to say, "I'm not the least bit impressed." She might be an Amhara, Hema thought, with that walnut skin, the high cheekbones. She is so pretty, probably a friend of Ghosh. A comb was stuck in her hair as if she were taking a break from teasing it into shape. Her leg shone from Nivea. She might even swallow a dab or two of Nivea now and then, in the belief it lightened the complexion. "For all I know, it works," Emma said, though she shuddered at the thought. Between the newer cinder block buildings were huts, the wattle walls unpainted and revealing their sticks, straw and mud. All it took was a pole stuck in the ground with an empty can inverted over the top to say, "This too is a Bunabet, and though we don't have an espresso machine, and though we sell home-brewed Tej and Tala instead of bottled St. George beer, we offer the same services as the other." The oldest profession in the world raised no eyebrows, even with Hema. She learned it was futile to object. It would have been like taking exception to oxygen. But the consequences of such tolerance were evident to her. Tubal and ovarian abscesses, infertility from gonorrhea, stillbirths, and babies with congenital syphilis. On the main road, Hema saw a work crew of grinning, dark-skinned, big-boned gurages supervised by a laughing Italian overseer. The gurage were southerners with a well-deserved reputation for being hard-working and willing to take on what locals wouldn't. Gibru, when he needed extra hands at missing, would simply step out of the front gate and yell, "Gurage!" Though of late, that could be seen as insulting, so it was safer to shout, "Kuli!" The crew was barefoot, but for the overseer and one man who had squeezed into ill-fitting plastic shoes, having cut holes in them for his big toes. By all rights, Hema should have been incensed by the sight of black laborers and a white overseer. And she wondered why she wasn't. Maybe it was because the Italians who stayed behind in Ethiopia after it was liberated were so easygoing, so ready to mock themselves, that they were hard to resent. Life for the Italians was what it was, no more and no less, an interlude between meals. Or maybe that was just the way of being that they found worked best in their circumstance. Hema saw the laborer stand still as soon as the overseer turned away. A snail's pace, but nevertheless, schools, offices, a grand post office, a national bank were coming up to match the grandeur of Trinity Cathedral, the Parliament Building, and the Jubilee Palace. The emperor's vision of his European-style African capital was taking shape. Perhaps it was because the emperor was still on her mind, and because a taxi was at the intersection where, in place of the string of shops, there once stood a gallows, but suddenly Emma was thinking about a scene that haunted her. It was at this very spot in 1946 that she and Ghosh, in their first months in Addis, had come upon a crowd blocking the road. Standing on the running board of Ghosh's Volkswagen, Hema had seen a crudely constructed frame and the three dangling nooses. A modified Trenta Quattro with military markings had pulled up. Three handcuffed Ethiopian prisoners on the flatbed were hauled to their feet. The men were coatless, but otherwise, in their shirts, shoes and pants, they looked as if they'd been interrupted while having dinner. An Ethiopian officer in Imperial Bodyguard uniform read from a piece of paper and tossed it aside. Hema watched, fascinated, as he put the noose over each head and positioned the knot to one side, behind the ear. The condemned seemed resigned to their fate, which was in itself a form of extreme bravery. The bearing of a tall older man made Hema certain the prisoners were military. This graying but upright prisoner spoke to the Imperial Bodyguard officer, who inclined his head to listen. He nodded and removed the noose. The prisoner then leaned over the truck and held his handcuffed wrists out to a weeping woman. She removed a ring from his finger and kissed his hand. The prisoner stepped back, looked down like an actor searching for his mark on stage, then bowed to this executioner, who returned the gesture and replaced the noose with the delicacy of a husband garlanding his new bride. Hema didn't understand what she was seeing. Not then, anyway. She half believed it to be a form of theatre. The violence of what followed, the truck roaring away, the thrashing forms,
The awkward and impossible angle of head on chest, the mad rush of onlookers to tear off the dead men's shoes, was less disturbing than the idea that she was living in a country where such things could take place. Sure, she'd seen brutality, cruelty in Madras, but they took the form of neglect and indifference to suffering, or they took the form of corruption. The event left Hema sick for days. She contemplated leaving Ethiopia. There'd been nothing about it in the Ethiopian Herald, no comment the government wished to make. The men had been planning revolution, so people said, and this was the emperor's response. He was keeping a fragile country on course. Hema had never forgotten the reluctant executioner. A handsome man, his temples forming a sharp angle with his brow, so his head was shaped like a hatchet. His nose was flattened at its base, as if from an old fracture. She remembered his stately bow to the condemned before he carried out his orders. She felt pity and even respect for him. The conflict between his duty and his compassion was revealed by that gesture. Had he refused to follow orders, his neck would have been stretched. Hema was sure he'd acted against his conscience. Maybe this is what keeps me in Addis all these years, Hema thought. This juxtaposition of culture and brutality, this molding of the new out of the crucible of primeval mud. The city is evolving, and I feel part of that evolution, unlike in Madras, where the city seems to have been completed centuries before I was born. Did anyone but my parents notice that I left?
Why don't you stay in India? There are so many poor women who die needlessly here in Madras,
her father had said half-heartedly on this visit.
You want me to give free service to the poor from this house? She said. If not, then get me a job. Let the city corporation hire me, or the government medical service. If my country needs me, why is it that they don't take me?
They both knew the answer. Jobs went to those willing to grease palms. She sighed, causing the taxi driver to look over. She was reliving the pain of saying goodbye to her parents yet again. The sight of barefoot peasants carrying impossible headloads and horse-drawn gharries plying the roads maintained the aura and mystique of this ancient kingdom that almost justified the fabulous tales of Prester John, who wrote in medieval times of a magical Christian kingdom surrounded by Muslim lands. Yes, it might be the era of kidney transplants in America and a vaccine for polio due to arrive even in India. But here, Hema felt she'd tricked time. With her 20th century knowledge, she had traveled back to an earlier epoch. The power filtered down from His Majesty to the Rasas, the Dejas Marshes, and the lesser nobility, and then to the vassals and the peons. Her skills were so rare, so needed for the poorest of the poor, and even at times in the royal palace, that she felt valued. Wasn't that the definition of home? Not where you are from, but where you are wanted? At about 2 in the afternoon, a taxi pulled up to the Chukka Brown gates of Missing, a world unto itself. The rock wall enclosed the hospital grounds and hid the buildings. Eucalyptus towered over the wall, and where there was no eucalyptus, there were firs and jacaranda and acacia. Green bottle shards poked up from the mortar at the top of the wall to dissuade intruders. Robbery and petty theft were rampant in Addis, though the sight of roses lapping over the walls softened this deterrent. The wrought iron gate, covered with sheet metal, was normally kept closed, and pedestrians were admitted through the smaller hinged door in the gate. But now the big gate was wide open, as was the pedestrian flap. Inside, Hema saw that Gibru's sentry hut door and shutter were also open, and when they crested the hill, she could see that every visible window and door in Missing's outpatient building was open too. In fact, she could see Gibru, the watchman, who happened to be a priest, in the process of propping open the woodshed door with a rock. Spotting the taxi, he came running, his army surplus overcoat flapping, his white priest's turban dwarfing his small face, his fly wand, cross and beads clutched in one hand. He seemed to be trying to shoo the taxi away. Gibru was a nervous chap, given to rapid speech and jerky movements, but he was far more agitated than was his norm. He looked stunned to see her, as if he'd never expected her to come back.
"Praise God for bringing you safely. Welcome back, madam. How are you? Are you well? God answered our prayers," he said in Amharic.
She matched him bow for bow as best she could, but he wouldn't stop until she said,
"Gibru!"
She held out a 5-burn note.
"Take bowl to Sheba Bar and fetch please Dorowat,"
she said, naming the delectable red chicken curry cooked in Ethiopian peppers, berbere. Her Amharic was crude, and she could only speak in the present tense, but Dorowat was a term she'd mastered early. And Dorowat had occupied her dreams her last few nights in Madras, after so many days of a pure vegetarian diet. The wat came poured on to the soft, crepe-like injera, and there would be more rolls of injera, which Hema would use to scoop up the meat. The curry would have soaked into the injera that lined the bowl by the time Gibru brought it. Her mouth watered just thinking of the dish.
"Indeed I will, madam. Sheba is best. Blessed is their cook. Sheba is..."
"Tell me, Gibru, why be doors and windows open?"
Now she noticed his nails and fingers were bloody, and his sleeves had feathers sticking to them, and feathers were caught up in his fly swish. It was then that Gibru said,
"Oh, madam, this is what I have been trying to tell you. Baby is stuck. The baby, and sister, and the baby."
She did not understand. She'd never seen him so worked up. She smiled and waited.
"Madam, sister is borning. She is not borning well."
"What? Say again?"
Perhaps being away and not hearing Amharic had made her misunderstand.
"Sister, madam,"
Gibru said, alarmed that he didn't seem to be getting through and thinking volume and pitch might help, though what came out was a squeak. Sister in missing always referred to Sister Mary Joseph Praise, for the only other nun there was Matron Hurst, who went by Matron, while all the other nurses were addressed as Nurse Almaz or Nurse Esther and not Sister. To Hema's astonishment, Gibru was crying, and his voice turned shrill.
"Passage is closed! I tried everything! I opened all the doors and windows! I split open a chicken!"
He clutched his belly and strained in a bizarre imitation of parturition. He tried English.
"Baby! Baby? Madam, baby?"
What he tried to convey was clear enough. There was no mistaking it. But it would have been difficult for Hema to believe it in any language. Chapter 7 Fito Terribilis. The doors to the operating theater burst open. The probationer shrieked. Matron clutched her chest at the sight of the sari-clad woman standing there, hands on her hips, bosom heaving, nostrils flaring. They froze. How were they to know if this was their very own Hema or an apparition? It seemed taller and fuller than Hema, and it had the bloodshot eyes of a dragon. Only when it opened its mouth and said,
"What bloody nonsense is Gibru talking? In God's name, what is going on?"
did their doubts vanish.
"It's a miracle,"
Matron said, referring to the fact of Hema's arrival, but this only further confused Hema. The probationer, her face flushed and her pockmarks shining like sunken nailheads, added,
"Amen."
Stone stood and unfurrowed his brows at the sight of Hema. Though he didn't say a word, his expression was that of a man who, having fallen into a crevasse, spotted the bowline lowered from the heavens. Hema, recalling this event many years later, said to me,
"My saliva turned to cement, son. A sweat broke out over my face and neck, even though it was freezing in there. You see, even before I digested the medical facts, I'd already registered that smell."
"What smell?"
"You won't find it in any textbooks, Marian, so don't bother looking. But it's etched here," she said, tapping her head. "If I chose to write a textbook, not that I have any interest in that kind of thing, I'd have a chapter on nothing but obstetric odors."
The smell was both astringent and saccharine, these two contrary characteristics coming together in what she'd come to think of as Fito Terribilis.
"It always means a labor room catastrophe. dead mothers or dead babies or homicidal husbands or all of the above.
She couldn't believe the amount of blood on the floor, the sight of instruments lying helter-skelter on the patient, next to the patient, on the operating table, assaulted her senses. But most of all, and she'd been resisting this, she couldn't accept the fact that Sister Mary Joseph Braise, sweet sister, who should have been standing, gowned, masked, and scrubbed, a beacon of calm in this calamity, instead lay all but lifeless on the table, her skin porcelain white and her lips drained of all color. Hema's thoughts became dissociated, as if they were no longer hers, but instead were elegant copperplate scrolling before her in a dream. Sister Mary Joseph Braise's left hand lying supine on the table drew Hema's eye. The fingers were curled, the index finger less so, as if she'd been pointing when sleep or coma overcame her. It was a posture of repose that one rarely associated with Sister Mary Joseph Braise. Hema's eyes would be drawn to that hand repeatedly as the hour unfolded. The sight of Thomas Stone brought her back to her senses and galvanized her. Seeing Stone in the hallowed place between a woman's legs that was reserved for the obstetrician rankled Hema. That was her spot, her domain. She shouldered him aside, and in his haste he knocked the stool over. He tried to explain what had happened, finding Sister, the discovery of a pregnancy, and then her obstructed labor, the shock, the bleeding that never stopped.
"Ayo, what is this?" she said, cutting him off, her eyes round with alarm, brow shooting up, and her mouth a perfect O.
She pointed at the bloody trephine and the open textbook resting by Sister Mary Joseph Braise's belly.
"Books and whatnots?"
She swiped them aside, and they clattered to the floor, the sound reverberating off the walls. The probationer's heart hammered against her breast like a moth in a lamp. Not knowing where to put her hands, she stuffed them in her pockets. She reassured herself that she had no part in the books and whatnots. Her failure, and she was beginning to see this, was a failure of sound nursing sense. She'd missed the gravity of Sister Mary Joseph Braise's condition when she delivered Stone's message. She'd assumed that others would look in on Sister Mary Joseph Braise. No one had been aware that Sister Mary Joseph Braise was that ill. And no one had told Matron. Sister Mary Joseph Braise moved her head, and Matron believed that she was at least transiently aware that Matron held her hand. But so relentless was her pain that Sister couldn't acknowledge Matron's kindness.
"In his hands I saw a large golden spear, and at its iron tip there seemed to be a point of fire."
Matron's guess from the fragments she could understand was that Sister Mary Joseph Braise's mumbled words were perhaps the words of Saint Teresa that they both knew so well.
"I felt as if he plunged it into my heart several times, so that it penetrated all the way to my entrails. When he drew it out, he seemed to draw them out, and left me inflamed with a great love for God. The pain was so severe, it made me moan several times. The sweetness of this intense pain is so extreme, there is no wanting it to end, and the soul is not satisfied with anything less than God."
But unlike St. Teresa of Avila, Sister Mary Joseph Braise surely did want the pain to end. And just then, Matron said, the pain seemed to loosen its grip on her belly, and Sister sighed and clearly said,
"I marvel, Lord, at your mercy. It is not something I deserve."
A brief period of lucidity with roving eye movements followed, along with more attempts at speech. But it was unintelligible. Lights splashed into the room, and Matron said it was as if a shroud that had formed in front of her face melted away. In that moment, as Sister Mary Joseph Braise looked around OT3, her operating theater for all these years, Matron thought the young nun realized that she was now the patient to be operated on, and that the odds were against her.
"Perhaps she felt she deserved to die," Matron said,
guessing at my mother's thoughts.
If faith and grace were meant to balance the sinful nature of all humans, hers had been insufficient, and so what she felt was shame. Still, she must have believed, even with all her imperfections, that God loved her and forgiveness awaited her in his abode, if not on earth.
Matron wondered if it scared my mother that she might die in Africa, a continent away from her birthplace. Perhaps deep in her, perhaps deep in every being, there lingers a desire to bring the circle of life back to its starting point, which in her case was Gochin. Then Matron heard my mother clearly whisper,
"Miserere me, Deus,"
before sound left her.
Matron carried her through the rest of the psalm in Latin, serving as her voice box while Sister Mary Joseph Braze's lips moved. "Behold, I was shapen in iniquity, and in sin did my mother conceive me. Purge me with hyssop, and I shall be clean. Wash me, and I shall be whiter than snow."
When she finished, Matron said the shroud was back. The light was slipping away from her world.
"Pick up the stool, Stone,"
Hema barked.
"And you,"
Hema said, snapping her fingers at the probationer,
"get your hands out of your pockets."
Stone set the stool upright just as Hemalata eased down onto it. The key bunch Hema had fished out to open her house was now tucked into the waist of a sari, and it jingled as she settled herself. Under the theater lights, the diamond in her nose sparkled. Strands of loose hair fell over her ears and in front of her eyes. Through pursed lips, she blew these wayward locks aside. She squared her shoulders, squared them to the horror and the unloveliness of what was before her. In that gesture, she slipped off the mantle of the traveler and put on that of the obstetrician. The task ahead, however difficult, dangerous, or unpleasant, was hers, and hers alone. Hema felt herself gasping for air. Her lungs would need a week to acclimatize. She'd come from sea level in Madras to an operating room 8,202 feet above sea level, not counting the stool on which she sat. Her nostrils flared with each inhalation, like a thoroughbred after the quarter mile. But her breathlessness came also from what was before her eyes. Gibru hadn't lost his mind or imbibed too much tala. He'd been telling the truth. The everyday miracle of conception had taken place in the one place it should not have, in Sister Mary Joseph Praise's womb. Yes, Sister Mary Joseph Praise was pregnant, had been for months before Hema left for India. And not just pregnant, but now in extremis. And the father? Who else? She glanced at Stone's grey face. But why not, she thought. Why should I be surprised?
"The incidence of cancer of the cervix,"
she remembered her professor saying, "is highest in prostitutes and almost zero in nuns.
Why almost zero and not zero? Because nuns are not born nuns. Because not all nuns were chaste before they became nuns. Because not all nuns are celibate."
That's neither here nor there, Hema admonished herself, while she thrust her hands into gloves that Matron produced. The probationer recorded in the chart the arrival of Dr. Hemalata. She chastised herself for not thinking of the gloves. Hemalata spread her own legs. Her feet were swollen from the long flight. She flexed her toes against the straps of her sandals and pawed the ground to get good purchase on the bloody floor. With the fingers of her left hand, she spread the labia. Then, with a motion made simple by countless repetitions, her right hand pulled down on the posterior rim, opening the birth canal to view.
"Rama, Rama, this is a bloody Stone Age utensil!"
Hemalata shouted, as she carefully disengaged first one half and then the other half of the skull crusher, slipping them over and then off the baby's ears. When the bloody instrument was free, she looked at it with distaste and flung it aside. Matron felt relief. Whatever happened, at least now a real obstetrician was in charge. She couldn't help but note how Hemalata and Stone had reversed roles. Hema was now the shouter and the flinger.
Matron offered the history that Sister Mary Joseph Braise had been in severe pain, great spasms of it, and then the pains had suddenly ceased, and she'd seemed almost lucid, talking. But now she had deteriorated again.
"My God,"
Hema said, knowing that in nature pains don't cease till a baby is out.
"It sounds like a uterine rupture."
It would explain all the blood on the floor. Placenta previa, a placenta plastered over the exit to the womb, was another possibility. Neither possibility was good.
"When did you stop hearing the fetal heart sounds?"
No one replied.
"Pressure?"
60 by palpation,
the nurse anesthetist said, after a pause, as if she expected someone else to volunteer the number that she was responsible for. Hema peered around Sister Mary Joseph Braise's swollen belly to fix Nurse Esqual with a withering look.
"Are you waiting for it to get to zero before you breathe for her? Put in a tracheal tube, connect it to the hand bellows. If she wakes, give her some intravenous pethidine. Tell me when you're done. Where's Ghosh? Have you sent for him?"
Nurse Esqual busied herself, grateful for her step-by-step instruction because her mind had seized.
"And who has gone for blood? What? Nobody? Am I dealing with idiots here? Go! Run! Run!"
Two people charged for the door.
"Round up anyone and everyone to give blood! We need lots of blood!"
Hema insinuated two fingers of her right hand around the fetal skull. With her other hand, she pushed down on Sister Mary Joseph Braise's belly. She peeked over the rise of the abdomen at Sister's face. It had gone grey, greyer than stones. Nurse Esqual, her hand shaking, managed to insert the tracheal tube. With every squeeze of the airbag, Sister's engorged breasts heaved up. Hema's hands were like extensions of her eyes as she explored the space that she thought of as the portal to her work. Fingers inside took their soundings, helped by the hand on the outside. She closed her eyes, the better to receive what her fingertips conveyed about the pelvic width, the baby's position.
"What have we here?" she said aloud.
Indeed, the baby was head down, but what was this? Another skull?
"Good God, stone!"
Himalata said, snatching her hand out as if she touched a hot coal. Stone looked on, not understanding, but afraid to ask. She fixed her gaze on Stone, her face taut, waiting for a reply, any reply, and prepared to shout it down when it came.
"Better out than in,"
Stone mumbled, thinking she meant his skull-crushing attempts.
"Damn it, Thomas Stone, don't quote me your idiot book! Do you think this is a joke?"
Stone, who didn't at all see this as a joke, who in fact saw that everything Hema was doing was something he could have and should have done, turned crimson. Hema turned back to probe once more that calamitous space in Sister Mary Joseph Brace's body where two lives were in jeopardy. Her words were like body blows directed at Stone.
"One prenatal visit? Could you have let me see her for at least one prenatal visit? I'd have cancelled my trip. Look at the soup we are in. Miracle, my foot. Completely avoidable. Completely avoidable!"
The last two words delivered like lashes. Stone stood as if in front of the headmistress. Hema seemed to expect him to speak, and so he stammered.
"I didn't know."
Himalata's jaw dropped. She stared at him. There was a part of her that was incredulous at the idea of Stone impregnating Sister Mary Joseph Braise. Who could imagine that? But the cynicism of the obstetrician who has seen everything crept back in.
"You're thinking virgin birth, Dr. Stone? Immaculate conception?"
She came around the table.
"In that case, guess what, Mr. Expedient Operator? This is better than the manger in Bethlehem. This virgin is having twins."
She paused to let it sink in.
"For goodness sake, couldn't you have done a cesarean section?"
Her sing-song intonation rose at the end, leaving the word cesarean section hanging over Stone's head.
"Gloves and gown, quick!" Himalata shouted. "C-section tray here! Wake up, all of you! Do you not want to save her? Hurry, hurry, hurry!"
She repeated this in Amharic.
"Tolo, tolo, tolo!"
in case English wasn't getting through.
The authority of her words kept them from retreating into the shock that had paralyzed them.
"And you nurses standing around all starched and useless,"
Hemalatha said as she pulled on a sterile gown and donned fresh gloves there wasn't time to wash.
"Couldn't you have said something to him, Matron?"
Matron looked to the floor.
"How long ago did the fetal heart sound stop? What was the fetal heart rate?"
"It happened too quickly.
Oh, shut up, Stone. One of you give me a straight answer. Otherwise, all of you just shut up. Pressure now?"
"Barely 60.
Where's the blood? Am I dealing with deaf as well as dumb people? Answer me."
The hospital had no blood bank, just a pint or two, if one were lucky, kept in a refrigerator. Patients' families were reluctant to give blood. Hema once pressed a husband to give blood for his wife, and he'd refused outright. When she suggested that his wife would surely give blood for him if the tables were turned, he said, "You don't know my wife. She's waiting for me to die to take my cows and property." Time and again, she and Ghosh and Stone and Matron would donate their own blood and prevail on some of the nurses to do the same. At least once a year, Ghosh would take his car and round up members of his cricket team to give blood.
"Has no one thought about blood?" Hema said again. "All of you who aren't needed here, go at once and give blood. This is one of our own, for God's sake. Go now. No, not you, Stone. Get gloved, man, for goodness sake. Make yourself useful. What was the fetal heart rate?"
The probationer kept her eyes focused on the chart, terrified at the idea of giving blood and not daring to look up. And she knew that no one had listened for a fetal heart. They'd been too preoccupied with the mother. The probationer drew a line through her C-section indicated entry, sensing that it reflected badly on Matron. It was no consolation to see Dr. Stone standing frozen, eyes downcast like a dog who disobeyed its master, every instinct telling it to slink away, but knowing that the slightest movement would only bring more punishment. Hema saw that Sister Mary Joseph Braze's face was losing all color, the eyelids lowered to quartermast, the hooded gaze now unfocused, a look that was so often a precursor to death.
"Pressure?"
"Can't find it."
"Doesn't matter. Pour in blood. Splash some iodine here. Let's go."
With that, she ripped open the sterile tray, grabbed the scalpel, and slashed through the skin, no time for sterility even, a vertical cut below the navel. Hema still couldn't believe what she was doing or whom she was cutting. She half expected Sister Mary Joseph Braze to sit up in protest. Instead, she heard the thud of a body falling and turned in time to see Matron crumpled on the floor. Chapter 8. Missing People.
"Custody of the body,"
was the first thing out of Matron's mouth when she revived. She'd passed out for probably fewer than 5 seconds. Everyone was in the same position, but now staring down at her. The probationer ran over to help. Despite Hema's protests, Matron clawed and kneed her way onto the anesthetist's stool, shouting,
"I'm not leaving!"
They were too busy to argue. She sat near the board that tethered Sister Mary Joseph Braze's arm, blood finally running from a bottle into a vein. Matron reached for that hand, bending over it, studying Sister Mary Joseph Braze's fingers. She didn't want to look at what the doctors were doing, their red gloves reaching in Sister's belly. Matron still felt lightheaded. As she massaged Sister's fingers to still the shaking in her own, the words came to Matron unbidden.
"Instruments of God."
Sister Mary Joseph Braze had beautiful fingers, slender and soft, each a delicate sculpture. Even at rest, they spoke of fine motor skills. Matron's, by contrast, were doughy white, the knuckles large and red, as if someone had taken a ruler to them. The knobby excrescences on the fingers spoke of nothing but age and toil and the caustic soaps and scrubbings which were the first tools of her profession. The fire burst of wrinkles on her palms spoke of her love for the Ethiopian soil and her willingness to plant and weed and dig alongside Gebru. He was guard, gardener, odd-job man, and priest, and he believed Matron had no business dirtying her hands. Matron felt her body shaking,
Lord, you can take me, she thought. But wait till they're done, because I don't want to distract them again. How she longed for a cup of coffee made from their own plant, grown on missing soil. She loved the gritty feel of the stone ground bean against her teeth, and the way it rolled down the throat like lead shot. The Italians had left behind their passion for macchiato and espresso so that every cafe in Addis served these beverages. Matron had no use for any of that. Missing coffee, brewed traditionally, that's what sustained her through the day and what she needed right now. Tears tracked down into the crevices at the angles of her mouth. One of my cherished own, she thought. The daughter I can never have, now with child. So many times at missing, Matron had become privy to an unspeakable secret revealed by catastrophic illness. Impending death had a way of unexpectedly unearthing the past so that it came together with the present in an unholy coupling. But Lord, she cried out silently, you could have spared us this. Spared her. As she stroked the younger woman's skin, Matron thought of the impulse that had made Sister Mary Joseph Praise choose to hide her body under a nun's habit or under a scrub suit and mask. It hadn't worked. Her covering exaggerated what little flesh was exposed. When a face was so lovely, lips so full, even a veil couldn't block its sensuality. A few years after Sister Mary Joseph Praise's arrival, Matron thought that the two of them should give up the white habit. The Ethiopian government had closed down an American mission school in Debrecen for proselytizing. Matron was in the business of running a hospital, not converting souls. She decided it might be politically smart to forego nun's habit. But when she'd seen Sister Mary Joseph Praise leaving Operating Theatre 3 in a skirt and blouse, Matron wanted to run out and cover her with a sheet. W.W. Gonifer, Missing's laboratory technician, standing next to Matron, had also seen Sister Mary Joseph Praise walk by in Mufti. He'd frozen like a setter pointing to a quail, a flush creeping from his collar to the roots of his hair, as if lust were a companion fluid to blood. Matron had decided then that nuns at Missing should remain in habit. A sudden exclamation that could have been from Hema or from Thomas Stone startled Matron, brought her back to the present. She jerked her head up, and before she could stop herself, she looked. What she saw made her shudder and feel as if she'd keel over again. She dropped her head down between her shoulders, closed her eyes, and forced her mind to find another focus. Matron had no saint whom she modeled herself after, someone to call on at these times. To think of St. Catherine of Siena drinking the pus of invalids, oh, how that disgusted her. Matron thought of such displays as a particular continental weakness, and she was impatient with celestial billing and cooing, bleeding palms and stigmata. And as for St. Teresa of Avila, why, she didn't have anything against Teresa. She didn't grudge Sister Mary Joseph Praise her adulation of Teresa, but secretly she agreed with Dr. Ghosh, the internal medicine physician at Missing, that St. Teresa's famous visions and ecstasies were probably nothing but forms of hysteria. Ghosh had shown Matron photographs that Charcot, the famous French neurologist, had taken of his patients with hysteria at the Salpêtrière Hospital in Paris. Charcot believed that these delusions sprung from a woman's uterus, hystera in Greek. His patients, who were all women, stood in smiling poses, provocative poses, Matron thought, that Charcot had labeled crucifixion and beatitude. How could anyone smile in the face of paralysis or blindness? La belle indifférence was what Charcot called this phenomenon. If Sister Mary Joseph Praise had visions, she wasn't one to speak about them. Some mornings, Sister Mary Joseph Praise had looked sleepless, her bright cheeks, her floating carriage, suggesting her feet strained to remain earthbound. Perhaps that explained her equanimity while working shoulder to shoulder with Thomas Stone, a man who for all his talents gave little encouragement to those who labored with him. Matron's faith was more pragmatic. She found in herself a calling to help. Who needed help more than the sick and the suffering, more so here than in Yorkshire. That was why she came to Ethiopia a lifetime ago. The few photographs, mementos, books, and certificates Matron brought with her had over the years been pilfered or mislaid. She never worried over this. One Bible, after all, would do just as well as the next. The essentials were also easily replaceable. Her sewing kit, her watercolors, her clothes. But she'd come to value the intangibles. The position she had grown to in the city where she was matron to everyone, even to herself. The resourcefulness she discovered that allowed her to make a cozy hospital, an East African Eden, as she thought of it, grow out of a disorganized jumble of rudimentary buildings, and the core group of doctors whom she'd recruited and who, by long association, had evolved into her cherished own. The umbilical cord that had connected her to the Society of Holy Child Order, to the Sudan Interior Mission, had shriveled and fallen off. They were all now self-exiled prisoners at Missing, she and her cherished own. Missing Hospital wasn't its name, of course, and now and then Matron tried to correct people, teach them to say Mission instead of Missing. But in truth, that year it wasn't even Missing. It was either Basel Memorial or Baden Memorial, she had to consult the paper taped to her desk to be sure, named after a generous church in either Switzerland or Germany. The Baptists of Houston were big donors, but they weren't at all concerned about naming the hospital. Dr. Ghosh liked to say that the hospital had as many forms as a Hindu god.
On any given day, only Matron knows which hospital we work in. And if we are walking into the Tennessee Baptist outpatient clinic or the Texas Methodist outpatient clinic, so how can you blame me for being late? I have to get out of bed and go find my place of work. Oh, Matron, there you are.
Prisoners they all were, Matron thought, smiling despite herself. Missing people who could hardly choose their cellmates. But even for Ghosh, who was without doubt one of the strangest of God's creations, Matron felt a maternal affection, and the parallel anxiety that comes with such an impish child. Matron sighed and was surprised to hear words tumble out of her mouth, and she felt the others in the operating theater staring at her. Only then did she realize that her lips had been busy shaping prayers. Since turning 50, Matron had noticed such dissonances and disconnections between her thought and action. They were becoming common. For example, at inopportune moments, her mind busied itself pasting images into a mental scrapbook. Why? When would she ever have occasion to recall all these memories? At a testimonial dinner? On her deathbed? At the pearly gates? She'd long ago stopped thinking literally about such matters. Her father, a miner who had lost himself in alcohol in the darkness of the tunnels, had loved the words Pearly Gates. On his tongue it sounded like the name of a blousy woman, one of many that had come between him and his conjugal duties. Still, Matron was sure of one thing. The image she witnessed when she'd inadvertently looked up a short while before, that was one she'd never, ever forget. What happened was this. The sun had suddenly freed itself from behind a cloud and, by some accident of elevation and season, presented itself directly on the ground-glass window of Operating Theatre 3. Lambent and white, it had bounced off the walls, reflected off glass, metal and tile, and there it was just when Hema or Stone or whoever it was made a loud exclamation, which was what had made Matron look up. That was when Matron saw them all bent over like hyenas over carrion, peering into Sister Mary Joseph Braze's open abdomen and its scandalous contents. She saw the light nosing its way between elbow and hip. Then the sunbeam fell directly on Sister Mary Joseph Braze's gravid uterus, which bulged out of the bloody wound like an obscenity on a saint's tongue. A blue-black collection of blood, a hematoma, stretched the broad ligament of the uterus, and it glowed in the light like the host. Matron felt that this had been the son's intent all along, to find the unborn. We have seen each other anew. We are unmasked. Yes, it was the kind of event that might be termed a miracle,
except that nothing happened. The laws of nature weren't suspended, which Matron felt was the sine qua non for miracles. But it was as if the